Another hero of the Anglo-Boer War, General Koos de la Rey, who's been much in song, popular culture these days. General Jacobus Hercules, or Koos de la Rey, is generally regarded as one of the bravest and most effective fighting generals of the Anglo-Boer War. He was born of Dutch and Huguenot descent, 22nd of October, 1847, in Winburg, in the Free State. His family moved to establish farm in the district of Wolmaranstad. During the Diamond Rush, Koos de la Rey worked as a transport rider on the routes, serving the diggings at Kimberley, and in 1876 he married Jacoba Elizabeth from the Creer family. His father-in-law, Hendrik Adrian Grief, was the founder of Lichtenburg, the City of Lights, the Mountain of Lights. The de la Reys bought the farm Elandsfontein and raised 12 of their own children and 6 other children who they adopted who had lost their parents. 18 children. Koos de la Rey was described as deeply religious, and his pocket Bible was always with him and frequently in his hands. He was described as formidable, with long, neatly trimmed brown beard and high forehead, deep-set eyes. He was 19 years old when he took part in his first battle. You know, just think how long it takes some people to grow up these days. We've got people in their 30s, 40s, 50s who haven't grown up yet. And we've got, there was a time when people had to be having their own farms at age 16, being involved in battles at age 11. So there was a time when 19-year-old was expected to be making life and death decisions. De la Rey fought in the Basutu War of 1865, in Secunda's War of 1876, and during the First War of Independence, 1880 to 81, De la Rey took over Piet Cronje's siege of the British fort at Potchefstroom. In 1885, he was elected commander of the Lichtenburg Commando. In 1893, he was elected a member of the Volksraad of the Transvaal, where he was a supporter of the progressive faction under General Piet Joubert, who opposed Paul Kruger's policy. So, first surprise, de la Rey was actually a liberal by his time standards. De la Rey consistently advocated accommodation of the Uitlanders and peace with Britain. During a Volksraad session, President Paul Kruger accused de la Rey of cowardice. And de la Rey replied that if the time for war came, he would remain in the field fighting long after the president had given up and fled for safety. Which, very aggressive thing to say, but as it so happened, that is what happened. And so the Anglo-Boer War did come, which of course de la Rey did everything to oppose. And he in fact voted against the declaration of war. And at the end, he determined to do his duty no matter what. And as it happened, de la Rey fired the first shots of Anglo-Boer War. And he was amongst the very last to leave the field. On 12th of October 1899, de la Rey led an attack that resulted in the first shots of the war being fired at the Battle of Kraipan. Attacking a British armoured train en route to Kimberley from Mafeking, de la Rey's men succeeded in derailing the train, and after a 5-hour firefight, the British surrendered. 26 British soldiers were captured, as well as 3 artillery guns. You understand, in the military, when they speak about a gun, they're referring to artillery piece. What most civilians refer to as a gun is either a revolver, a pistol, a rifle, a machine gun. But a gun, in military terms, always refers to artillery, cannon, in popular terms. So when they said they captured 3 guns, obviously rifles are not included in that, and large quantities of ammunition. From the beginning, General de la Rey argued with General Cronje's strategy of besieging Mafeking and Kimberley. He said, this will tie down too many men, it's a waste of time. Which it was, actually. And so they wasted their time sieging these towns when they could have been racing for the ports. Taking the ports of Durban, Port Elizabeth, Cape Town would have prevented the British resupplying and so on. But Cronje had no forward vision. The younger generals didn't have the authority to change the tactics of the war at that stage. These time-consuming, ultimately unproductive efforts would be frustrated as the British could call upon vast resources to raise the siege and to reinforce their men. De la Rey was overruled and ordered to prevent the British reinforcing Kimberley. On the 25th of October 1899, at the Battle of Graspan, de la Rey sought to delay General Methuen's 1st Division, as to prevent him relieving Kimberley. On the 28th of November 1899, at the Battle of Modderrivier, de la Rey insisted that his men dig trenches along the banks of the Modderrivier. This is the first example of trench warfare in the war. They camouflaged up the trenches on the far side of the river, not what was expected, not normal tactics at that time. They succeeded in holding back the enemy until nightfall, and when they withdrew, Delarey was wounded and his son Adrian was killed in this battle with General Mathieu. At the Battle of Magersfontein, 11th of December, Delarey and his men entrenched on the flat ground at the base of the Magersfontein Hills. Now, that was very unexpected, and I've been there too and seen these. It's still got quite a lot of the entrenchments visible. So the British shelled the high ground, assuming the Boers would be positioned on the high ground, which was good military sense. That's the way it made sense. But so therefore they were shelling the high ground, but no one was there. And when night attack came by the Scottish Highland Regiment, they were decimated by the accurate fire of the entrenched Boers. And British General Warcrop was killed in the battle. Now just understand these Mauser 7.7mm that the Boers are holding at phenomenally fast round. And if you're doing it flat, you see, if you're shooting down, you might get your target. But if you're shooting flat, if you miss the person in front, you get the person behind them. And the British were moving in close order. But the Mauser rifles shots were so fast, they would get two, maybe three people. One bullet. Straight through. That fast around. So the British didn't expect. They thought, we've shelled the top, the Boers would have fled, now we're marching across. And meanwhile, they march into murderous fire because the trench were at the base of the mountain, which nobody expected. So even if they missed one person, they'd get the next one. They might get three for one bullet. When Delarey was organizing resistance to General French's advance in the Colesberg area, General Cronier was trapped and surrendering with his entire army at Paardenberg. And you just see the difference between well-led Boers and badly led Boers. Made a huge difference, all difference in the world. Bloemfontein fell on the 13th of March 1900. Pretoria fell on the 5th of June 1900. President Kruger fled via Portuguese East Africa to Europe. And now only a corps of bitter Einders remained in the field to oppose the British occupation of the Orange Free State and the Transvaal. They couldn't stop the cities from being taken, but they could sure make life difficult for the British thereafter. So after the surrender of Cronier at Paardenberg, 27 February 1900, Delarey sought to stem the British tide with the Battle of Driefontein and Doornkop, and he defeated Colonel Robert at Silskaks Nek. And his men regularly took the guns of the British, the artillery pieces. 3rd of December 1900, he captured 126 wagons loaded with clothing, car boots, all kinds of food supplies, and this was at Buffelsport. Delarey's charging tactics resulted in many losses for the British side. He managed to surprise them, charge in. During this guerrilla war phase, General Delarey became renowned as the Lion of the Western Transvaal, and he lived and worked amongst the Magaliesberg Mountains, which is almost impossible to police or control, because the British could be marching along this way, they could be seen for a long distance, they could be through the valley down to another place before they even get there, so it was ideal terrain for him. Instead of dismounting to fight, because the Boers were understood to be mounted infantry, you'd charge in, get down, get into positions and then fire, he trained his men to fire at full gallop from the saddle. For 2 years he led a highly successful mobile campaign, winning battles at Mudville, Neutgedacht, Driefontein, Donkershoek, Eisterspruit, Tweersbos. At Eisterspruit, he captured enough ammunition and supplies to reinvigorate the Boer forces. So the enemy has become my quartermaster. At Tweersbos, he captured General Methuen himself. Now bear in mind, his son, Adrian, had died at the hands of General Methuen's forces. So how would he react? Well, General Delarey was renowned for his chivalrous behavior and his Christian conduct towards his enemy. Regularly, he had released hundreds of captured enemy as he had no means to support them. As General Methuen had been injured by his horse falling on his leg, Delarey released him to return to his lines where he could receive medical attention. More than that, he organized a cart and two horses which he could ill spare to let General Methuen and send him down the road to where he could get medical attention from British forces. Now, considering that the British were shooting Boer prisoners of war for wearing some parts of British uniform, which, let's face it, they didn't have their own uniforms. It could be cold, they're running out of things, next thing. But if they were found, you had British boots on or his jacket, because then they treat him as a spy, which was nonsense. But the thing is, they were scrounging and scavenging for ammunition and even clothing sometimes. So they might have had some elements of a British uniform, like a ammunition belt, something like that, water bottle. Next thing, they'd be accused of being spies because they're wearing some parts of British equipment. So you don't determine your standards, your ethics, by your enemy's ethics. You must adhere to a higher standard, because the laws of war are not there just to protect captured enemy or defeated prisoners of war. It's there to protect you from becoming the very thing you are meant to be fighting. And this is what happens in many wars, is that people actually find themselves being lowered to the level of their enemies, and after a while they become the very thing they hate and oppose. It's so important that one has a standard, such as pilot saying, you'll never shoot at a pilot in a parachute, for example. Those were standards which were adhered to. Even after suffering defeats such as at the Battle of Roivaal in April 1902, Deloraye's commanders numbered up to 3,000 men in the field to the very end. And General Deloraye led the last cavalry charge of the war. So it can be said he fired the first shots and he was in the last cavalry charge of the war. This is where the war was. The red area is controlled by the British, and the Southern Republics of Transvaal and Orange Free State. Plainly, they were outmaneuvered, outgunned, outnumbered, encircled, and they only had one friendly port, and that was to Lourenço Marques, or what today is Maputo in Portuguese East Africa. Throughout the war, Deloraye's wife, Jacoba, evaded capture and imprisonment in the concentration camps by the British by travelling and living in the veld for 19 months. Imagine kind of tough Boer mother she must have been to travel with a field commander for 19 months on the road, on the saddle. That's tough. Her book, A Woman's Wanderings and Trials During the Anglo-Boer War, was published in 1903. Mevrouw Deloraye. Lord Kitchener requested to meet General Deloraye at Clarksdorp for a parley, and the huge public pressure being mobilized by Emily Hobhouse in Britain had made the war extremely unpopular, and political pressure was being brought to bear on Kitchener to end the war at all costs, quickly, now. And so, some of the statistics: the British in 1902 had 450,000 men in the field. Over 500,000 British soldiers served in South Africa, but 450,000 were there at the end. And their casualties were huge. They had over 5,700 died in action, 2,000 died of wounds, 13,000 died of diseases, most of that from typhoid and cholera. Invalid at home, 97,000. Invalid at home, wounded and unable to keep fighting effectively. So the British forces, 365,000, and the colonial, 82,000. Colonial would have been Australia, New Zealand, even Canadian. And so this was a very, very, very costly war for the British. It cost them a fortune in money and a lot of people. And again, you can see some of the whole backdrop against which they were fighting in the field. This Bitter Ender monument really is very true for Deloraye too. Deloraye is this man positioned prominently in the foreground, just as De Wet is over on the left. Christian De Wet, Deloraye, and General Botha finally agreed to sign the Treaty of Vereeniging on 31 May 1902. So now, look at the importance of 31 May. End of the Anglo-Boer War, 31 May 1902. Union of South Africa, 31 May 1910. Republic of South Africa, independence, 31 May 1961. Understand why 31 May was Republic Day. It was an important symbolism. And so the shame of the surrender was to a large extent mitigated by making sure the Union of South Africa came about in 31 May. And then that disgrace of being under the British flag for so many years, they made sure that our republic was declared 31 May. So dates are important, symbolic, significant. In return for acknowledging the sovereignty of King Edward VII, the Boers were promised self-government, granted in 1906 to the Transvaal in 1907 to Orange Free State, and for the Union of South Africa in 1910. So the generals, after surrendering on the battlefield, ended up winning the whole country in 8 years. Exactly, to the day. In addition, the British promised £3 million compensation to help rebuild the homes and farms, which was done, but that was only a small part of the damage done. You couldn't replenish the crops and the herds and, of course, irreplaceable family heirlooms and so much more. The destruction, the wanton, deliberate, scorched earth destruction, that was the policy of Lord Kitchener under the instructions of Lord Milner. Absolutely horrific, devastating. So in 1907, Deloray was elected to the Transvaal Republic, and he is a delegate to the National Convention, which led the Union of South Africa in 1910. He became a senator, and he supported the first Prime Minister, General Louis Botha, in his attempts to unite Boer and Brit. So, interesting, I mean, he was a liberal before the war, he was a reluctant warrior, and he was enthusiastic to bring about union. When the South African Communist Party inspired white miners to riot in 1914, interesting, the Communist Party had a slogan at the time, "Workers the world unite for a white South Africa." Intriguing, because it shows they don't care about the workers, they don't care about the miners, they don't care about the whites, they don't care about the blacks, they don't care about anyone. The communists will do anything they want to, you know, whether it's women's rights, workers' rights, black rights, whatever it is, youth, what, it doesn't matter, they don't care about any of them. They will just use whatever they can as a pretext to gain power. The fact that the Communist Party of South Africa, which today controls the ANC, and that they were happy to mobilize white miners against black miners, just shows their mentality. But Deloray was the one that they sent in for the commander to crush the miners, the communist miners. He became a senator, and he supported the Prime Minister, General Louis Botha, in his attempts to unite Boer and Brit. With the outbreak of the First World War, Senator Deloray strenuously opposed South Africa's involvement in the war. He was against the Anglo-Boer War, he's against this war, so he's consistent. He's totally consistent, but he's coming at from a different perspective from Martina Steyn and Christian De Wet. He's actually a liberal person, is thinking, and he did not want war. As many South Africans were of German descent, 40% of the Boer bloodline is German, and as Germany had been sympathetic to their struggle for freedom during the Anglo-Boer War, he regarded as morally indispensable to attack German Southwest Africa, who were their neighbours who had never done any harm to them and posed no threat to South Africa at the time. Minuscule force of German forces in Southwest Africa. There's no way they could have possibly even defend themselves, let alone attack South Africa. So in Parliament, Deloray advocated neutrality, stating he is utterly opposed to war unless South Africa was directly attacked. We will fight in self-defense. We are not going to fight an aggressive war. So on the 15th of September 1914, his friend, General Beyers, Christian Beyers, the Commandant General of Armed Forces, resigned his commission in protest and sent his car to fetch General Deloray to consult with him. As the two generals set out for Potchefstroom military base, where General Kemp had also resigned, General Deloray was shot dead at a police roadblock, which has got to be assassination. General Deloray was one of the most famous figures, and his features were well known, his photographs were well published. It couldn't have been a person on the country who didn't know who General Deloray was. To shoot him dead in his car at a roadblock, although the official statement claimed he'd been mistaken for a bank robber, many were convinced that he had been deliberately assassinated because of his opposition to South Africa's involvement in Britain's war, and he was travelling to a meeting at a military base to address the soldiers there on this very issue. So this was a very clumsy assassination. There is a monument of General Deloray and his horse in the Deloray Square in front of the Lichtenburg City Hall, his adopted home. Great interest in the courage of Deloray has been rekindled by the Deloray song sung by Bok van Bleek. Koos Deloray will always be respected as the bravest of the brave, the lion of the Western Transvaal. And there are books such as Johannes Mankie's Lion of the West, and his wife, Mrs. General Deloray, A Woman's Wanderings During the Anglo-Boer War. Very interesting. And there's some good materials on him. I've got a chapter on him also in our sketches from South African history. Any questions on General Deloray? It is readily available in Afrikaans. To get it in English would be harder, but yes, interesting man, this top hat. You think of him as a real field man, but he was a respected senator. Yes, his wife's book would be fascinating to read. I'd love to get hold of it too.
I wonder where one would find it. I still think it would be quite scarce.
Let me tell you, the best place to find anything is secondhand bookshops. We've got some treasures in our secondhand bookshop. I get most of my good materials in secondhand bookshops. Long Street, we've got a few treasure houses there, and it changes regularly. You've got to go back regularly because people they inherit a whole lot of books of the grandmother maybe, and then they take them and sell them, and you know, we can really pick up a lot of good things at those bookshops. So, any other comments? They knew one another. Nobody really liked Jan Smuts. Actually, Jan Smuts was a very cold fish to describe some people. Jan Smuts was the only person involved in both the founding of the League of Nations and the United Nations. He wrote the charter for the League of Nations and the United Nations, the preamble for the Declaration of the UN and so on. Smuts was a key figure in the First World War and a key figure in the Second World War. He was involved in the Treaty of Versailles, which is the worst treaty in the history of mankind, guaranteed the Second World War, and he was involved in the whole everything at the end of the Second World War. During the Second World War, Winston Churchill described Smuts as his number one confidant and advisor, and it was Churchill's wish that if something happened to him that incapacitated him during the war, that Smuts would take over as Prime Minister of Great Britain. So Smuts was in lock, stock and barrel with the British Empire. He was an empire man, totally. And if you want to know about it, the book written by Stephen Mitford Goodson on Jan Smuts is staggering. It's only 100 odd pages, but I read it in the space of a couple of days. I was just astounded at the amount of information. That, we're not dealing with Jan Smuts right now, but... I would say that Jan Smuts was certainly the worst prime minister we've ever had in this country. Speaking about prime ministers, under him, we started the Southern Reserve Bank. And the Southern Reserve Bank, in fact, Stephen Mitford Goodson, his biographer, was the director of the Reserve Bank. He's written about just what an iniquitous, outrageous ripoff the Reserve Bank is, how it basically keeps us in bondage and makes us slaves to the New World Order. So if I can just put it in a simple way, the Southern Reserve Bank is not South African. It has no reserves and it's not a bank. The Southern Reserve Bank is a bunch of private bankers, basically Rothschilds, who, when the government wants to get a loan, they come to the Reserve Bank and... could you give us R1 billion, say? No problem, that's what the bank exists for. Open a drawer, so to speak, pull out a checkbook, sign out R1 billion, and at that point they create the money. The money doesn't exist. The Reserve Bank just created the money out of thin air. It's a blip on a computer screen. Now they print at the government press the money. I mean, if you and I print South African rand notes, it's called counterfeiting. If the government does, it's called inflation. So they produce this R1 billion. Now, R1 billion didn't exist. It's just a created out of thin air. Literally created out of thin air. That's what I've got from The Economist. But the interest you pay every year, that the taxpayer pays every year for that loan, is real. Now, the average poor woman used to pay... the average poor woman used to have an average of 12 children at about the time of the Anglo-Boer War. Today, what are we on? 1.8, 2.2, something like that. The big thing that changed everything was forcing women out of the workplace, out of the home, into the workplace to pay extra taxes, need a two-income home, and so on. What this has done is it's made the West now implode, so that the West is now dying. You've got more people on pension than paying taxes in some countries. And you've got far more old people than you've got young people in many countries, except for the foreign migrants come from Muslim countries and so on. Well, of course, that changes the whole thing. So this has apparently been a deliberate campaign to destroy Christian Europe. It's not just the world wars, it's the destruction of the home. Because a mother who has to go out and work will not have as many children as a mother who's a stay-at-home mother. I mean, just basic fact. I was at Cape Town 2010, the largest missions conference in history. 4,200 delegates from 197 countries gathered together in Cape Town 2010. That was on the 100th anniversary of the Edinburgh Conference in 1910. So, to compare Edinburgh 1910 with Cape Town 2010, well, there's no comparison, it's contrast. In 1910, the consensus of the mission delegates there was that if present trends continue, the Great Commission will be fulfilled by about 1960, all false religions will be extinct, there'll be no more Islam, Buddhism, so on, Protestant, evangelical Christianity will be predominant in every country in the world by 1960. Now, that's the year I was born, 1960, and we're far from that. And when I, and, but they weren't being unrealistic, because of the greatest sense of missions, the 19th century, there was every expectation. I mean, Christians ruled the world. With the exception of Japan and China and the Ottoman Empire, the rest of the world was owned by Christians, whether Orthodox, Catholic, or Protestant, and the superpowers were Protestant. And nobody could have foreseen that Europe, as Christendom, and as the greatest missionary sending continent on the planet, also the military superpowers, spiritual superpowers, economic superpowers in every way, that they would decline into being in danger of becoming Eurabia within a century. Who could have foreseen that? When I went to Cape Town 2010, what were we discussing? Not a Christian country on the planet, not one country in the world could be called truly Christian by 2010. Huge amounts of unreached people. We've got more than 30 million slaves in the world today. We've got more people enslaved today than there were when William Wilberforce succeeded in destroying the slave trade in 1807. Widow burnings coming back to India. Female genital mutilation, so-called Islamic circumcision, on the rise. Burning of brides in India, on the rise. You could mention just about every kind of evil which had been extinct in 1910 has come back. Not to mention typhoid and all these other things which they were getting rid of. So the world's gone backwards. The evolutionists say everything's getting better, but Operation World and what I've been studying, well, not really. Things have been getting worse in many ways. How did we go from the greatest century of missions into the worst century of persecution? What happened between 1910 and 2010? Well, 1914, world wars. But the world wars were banksters. The same Rothschilds who engineered the Anglo-Boer War behind the First World War, and the goal was expressly to get the Christians to commit auto-genocide, get the Christians to kill one another. No one could have possibly defeated Christian Europe, except that Christian Europe fought and defeated one another. And who were the winners? Soviet Union, communism. They rose at the expense of Christian Europe. And of course, we in Africa, we suffered the most in many ways, because as Europe was compelled to pull out of Africa too early, who came in? The Russians, the Chinese, the Americans, Cold War, playground for the superpowers, and tens of millions of Africans have died as a result of the decolonization policies forced by particularly FDR and Truman's policies, and Eisenhower as well, what they did to undermine. And every time Europe pulled out of Africa, it's not like the people in Africa got free, it's that they then became puppets of the Soviets, the Cubans, or some other megalomaniac mass-murdering thugs. And you had these disastrous situations. Congo, you could travel from one side of the Congo to the other in 4 days, back before the Belgians left. Today, you couldn't get across the Congo in 4 months with a four-wheel drive vehicle. You could not. Not possible. The infrastructure is destroyed. You could travel faster with a bicycle in South Sudan in 1920s, 1930s, and you can travel the four-wheel drive today, same distances. The roads, everything is worse now than it was back there. It's just, but forget that, the morals. the crime, the violence, the terrorism, abortion. You could go on so many different levels. So this is another major theme of mine is comparing the greatest century of missions to the worst century of persecution. I've done a book on the greatest century of missions, work on the worst century of persecution in the 20th century history. And those books we work on, the trust will be out early next year. But just the understanding of how evil people manage to undermine Christian civilization and put us backwards while having people celebrate their oppressors and love their chains and sing songs about how wonderful it is that actually everything's gone more anti-Christian. And the average Christian doesn't even notice how much we've lost. We've lost just think back in 1950. You could drive from Cape Town to Cairo in a normal car. You wouldn't even need a four-wheel drive vehicle. You wouldn't need a passport. And there wouldn't be a roadblock. And you probably wouldn't even meet a pothole. And today, our technology is so much better. We have got every year 5 million Africans die of cholera every year. 2 million Africans die of malaria every year. Things that were wiped out under colonials. We have got such a deterioration on health and every other level, education as well. There was a time when you used to have to debate in Latin to enter university. Now you get remedial English for graduates of university. You go down the road to Old Mutual in Pines, they have an English teacher who teaches remedial English to MBAs who've graduated from University of Cape Town or Wits. MBAs, Master of Business Science, Business Administration. They need to be taught remedial English at Old Mutual. And they've got chartered accountants who need to be taught by a high school maths teacher how to do computational skills, basic computation for a chartered accountant. So we've got people coming out of university whose degrees are worthless, absolutely worthless. And yet we've got to say, oh, how wonderful everything is. But it's not wonderful. We should not be celebrating our chains and our oppression. Or the fact that our money's been debased.
Where did the Rothschilds get out of this pot of money? Or is that it?
No, it's not just money. It's power, mostly. But remember, there's a hatred for Christianity. There's a desire to destroy Christianity. And they even say to defile the Christians.
This is also a long-term strategy.
Very long-term strategy. So there's been desire to defile the arts and architecture and science and the music, to debase everything. And they want to see the Christians' children anti-Christian. And they want to degrade everything Christian. There is a real... at the height, you've got the Freemasonry hands. Now, some people call these things conspiracy theories. It's more like fact, not theory anymore, because we've got so much documentation. That's why I think one of the best films that came out recently on this is Agenda 2, Masters of Deceit, showing the anti-Christian agenda. For example, you take a man like John Dewey, who's major Marxist, whose fingers are all over the modern secular humanist education system. He had the express idea of turning the teachers into evangelists for humanism, basically, to promote secular humanist atheistic ideologies. It's the Gramsci strategy, the Termite strategy. Anyway, that's going slightly off our topics here. I've got newsletters on Christian Action at the back here and in the hallway, which deal with everything from false flags to second phase of the revolution and all of the different other things going on there. But I just see in South Africa's history how we have had so much of our heritage stolen, defiled, destroyed.
Are there Rothschild Freemasons?
Yes, there are. That's not to say every Freemason is a bad or an evil person. There's a lot of people on the ground in Freemasonry who just see it as a way of getting jobs and preferred contracts and so on. But as you go higher up, when you get up to the 33-degree Masons and so on, it's seriously occultic, Luciferian, I mean, as in satanic. And, for example, when the communists took over East Germany, what was the symbols they put on the DDR flag, the East German flag? Freemasonry symbols, totally. You get the American money, you get an American dollar, and you've got Freemasonry symbols from the all-seeing pyramid eye, even their New World Order in Latin and things like this. Is this? Oh, they've got a hexagram on there. They've got 13 points, which, again, 13 is quite a occultic number. So you take the hexagram, it's three sixes. It's six triangles, 6 points, six lines. That hexagram, which is also part of the, on the $1 note. Disturbing. Anyway, any other questions or comments? Yes?
The Russian Rothschild connection. They seem to be on the opposite poles.
They are. The Rothschilds' biggest hatred until 1917 was the Tsar of Russia and the Russians. The Russians were the only major power in Europe that did not have a Rothschild-controlled bank. So you had the Lord Nathan Rothschild and Mayor Rothschild and Jacob Rothschild and all those characters. Their sons were controlling the banks of New York, Frankfurt, Berlin, Vienna, Paris, London, of course. in fact, Lord Nathan Rothschild said, I care not what puppet you place on the throne of England, who's on whom the empire never sits. Whoever controls the money supply of England controls England, and I control the money supply. And, of course, they did. So, as was said by one of the Rothschild mothers, if my sons didn't want war, there would be none. And now, I was quite challenged by this when Stephen Mitford Goodson started speaking about the Rothschild connection to Anglo-Boer War. And I mean, I've never heard of a bank. I mean, what's economics got to do with war? I've always understood wars are caused by geopolitical, maybe even ideological, perhaps religious, and so on. But the economic cause of war never crossed my mind until a few years ago when we had Stephen Mitford Goodson here, this ex-director of the Reserve Bank, and he started laying out the economic reasons for the wars. Like, how many countries are targeted? Let's just take in our lifetime, right now. Is it a coincidence that Libya, Syria, and Iraq, and Iran don't have Rothschild banks? They've got their own national banking system. And, like, they're the only countries that didn't. And that these major wars are often perpetrated against countries who've done, they're not a threat. I mean, in what way is Syria a threat to anybody? Syria's done nothing to America. They, in no way. Similarly, what has Libya done against America and so on? Well, when you get down to it, they weren't on the correct banking system. Why did Hendrik Verwoerd get assassinated? Well, he initiated an investigation into the damage being done by Anglo-American De Beers, and he also looked at an alternative to South Reserve Bank, and next thing gets assassinated. On the 6th of the 9th, 1966, 6966, they even chose the date when he was being assassinated. And again, the Verwoerd book gives more details on how this was. The orders came from the top. CIA was involved. It was the bankers determined. And he had to be killed in as public a way as John F. Kennedy by the same kind of people. John F. Kennedy also had to be a public assassination against the bigger enemy of the banks because he was starting to issue Federal Reserve notes without regard to the American Reserve Bank. And of course, the US Reserve Bank's not American, it's got no reserves and it's no bank either. Same sort of thing. You've got these sort of very public kinds of vicious assassination, like with the Tsar of Russia. So the Tsar of Russia had opposed and kicked out the Rothschilds and so on. Their hatred for them was so great, hence the way how they vindictively, in many ways, they started the war primarily to destroy Russia. That was the beginning of the war. That was the ultimate first goal. And that's why they didn't just take over from the Tsar. They killed him and his wife and his daughters. There was this vindictive hit. It's this kind of malicious, satanic, occultic kind of human sacrifice that was part of the whole Bolshevik Revolution. Which is, we just passed the 100th anniversary of the murder of the Tsar's family. July this year, the 100th anniversary of that. So the vindictiveness, the way how they had Verwoerd stabbed in Parliament, in his seat, and of course John F. Kennedy next to his wife on a visit to Dallas, Texas, this sort of very public. So it's those sort of people. Now, I've heard these sort of things now from many different sources, but to get it from an economist pointing out what economic crimes, thought crimes, they committed by trying to go outside of the system, what you meant to do. For example, Gaddafi, before he got ousted and murdered, had just organized that they weren't going to use the dollar as the exchange rate for their petroleum, but they're going to sell their petroleum for gold. And there was a similar kind of thing going on in Iraq. Iraq had one of the biggest gold reserves in the world. It got totally pilfered. One of the greatest museums and wildlife zoos and all the rest. And the pilfering, the looting of Baghdad. And what happened to that gold, by the way? And a whole lot of other things like this. And the destruction of Iraq, for what purpose? Iraq was one of the Christian countries in the Middle East. It had 1.6 million Christians not that long ago. When the war began, it had 1.3 million Christians. Today, there's not even 200,000 Christians left in Iraq. Iraq was 1 in 6 of the population of Christians as recently as the Second World War. The entire bodyguard and even the catering staff of Saddam Hussein were Christians. You go to downtown Baghdad and the Baptist Church in downtown Baghdad. It's a beautiful organ, gift of His Excellency the President Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was obviously a ruthless dictator. I'm not saying he's a good person, but he protected the Christians. He didn't allow persecution of the Christians. And he had the Christians as bodyguards because he knew Christians don't assassinate. He couldn't trust Muslim bodyguards. They might assassinate him for any different reasons. Why does America go for this place where Christians were protected? The second largest group of Christians in the Middle East outside of Egypt and Lebanon would be Syria. In fact, Syria's got a very large percentage, 6% of the population is Christian. It's very large in the Middle East. Only larger would be Egypt, where they've got about 12% of Christians. So Syria, again, a disproportionately high percentage of the army of Syria, of Assad, are Christians. Because they know there's only one thing standing between them and Muslims wanting to behead them, destroy their church and kill their wives and children, is Assad. He's a secular leader who keeps the Muslim jihadists in check. And so when I was growing up, the Americans were the good guys, and the Russians are the bad guys, and the Russians supported the terrorists, and today Russia's supporting the Christians and protecting the Christians against terrorists who are funded by the Americans and the NATO, like ISIS. It's just insane. It's exactly the reverse of what was when I was growing up. So to move from the situation, the Russians are no longer enemies, they're now actually our friends, and NATO is actually fighting against Christians. At each war, just think of when NATO has been mobilized. They go into Yugoslavia and they take the side of the Muslim jihadist terrorists, Bosnians, against the Christian Serbs. Why? They go into Somalia to help Muslims. They won't help Christians in Rwanda because, UN doesn't help Christians. They might bomb Christians, kill Christians, starve Christians, but they're not going to help Christians. They'll help Muslims, but they'll never help Christians. And it's, if you make a mistake once, we're all human, we'll make a mistake. Make the same mistake 10, 15, 20 times, you've got a hidden agenda. There's no way that foreign officers of Britain and America and NATO would be that stupid, because if they keep doing the same thing, you've got to assume that's their intention, which is they're working against Christian interests, Italy, Iraq, Syria, you know.
It's a policy
question. Sorry?
It's a policy.
Exactly, it must be the policy. It can't just be an accident. Otherwise, they do the right thing sometimes by accident. If they were just no, they're treacherous. And I think it's been well. We have put a lot of books on the shelves here in this library, like Ally Betrayed, China. How the US went out of its way at the Second World War to betray the nationalists into the hands of the communists in China. Sent the aid to Mao Zedong. So Ally Betrayed Nicaragua, Ally Betrayed Cuba, Ally Betrayed Iran, of course, Rhodesia. There's so many examples. The head of UNITA Freedom Fighters in Angola, Janice Savimbi, who we knew, said to me, now he's pro-American. He had read, quote George Washington and Jefferson Davis and Thomas Jefferson, a whole lot. He's really, loved a lot of what America stood for, but he was a realist. He said, it is better to be America's enemy than America's friend. If you're America's enemy, you may be bought, but if you're America's friend, you'll certainly be sold. Then he said, do you know why there hasn't been a revolution in America for over 200 years? There's no American embassy in America. That is not much of a joke. The American embassy has been at the heart of many revolutions, including in Iran and Rhodesia and South Africa. It was exposed right back in 1976. The U.S. consulate had reading rooms in places like Soweto. What happened in the reading rooms? Marx, Lenin, Engels, Trotsky, revolution, liberation theology. It might as well have been Moscow's propaganda agency. The American State Department was running a revolutionary, when you speak about reading room, it had videos of videos, and for 16-mm projectors and so on. But there's all kinds of films, books and so on. They were radicalizing the youth of Soweto prior to the 1976 Soweto riots and all that sort of thing. They've been revolutionizing countries all over the world. There's been a lot of destruction done. And we haven't even touched the British Foreign Office. What the British Foreign Office does is just beyond disgraceful. What they've done to destroy Christian civilization in Africa and betray people in the hands of Marxist mass murdering thugs like Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, just as one example. You could go for several others, but like Mobutu Sese Seko, pathological kleptomaniac of Congo, who, when he was asked by an interviewer, how is it possible that you're the fifth richest man in the world and your country is the sixth poorest? And he said, I'm the fourth richest man in the world. Kind of proves one's point. And he, of course, was being funded and supported by State Department, British Foreign Office, that sort of thing. Because it was part of the Cold War, you know. Moscow had their people, Peking had theirs, Washington, London had theirs, and all playing games in Africa. And just millions of Africans dying at the same time in this Cold War game. And now it gets even worse. Of course, we could speak about the people funding Malema. If you think Julius Malema gets his instructions just from Karl Marx and so on, you're wrong. He's got the same controller as Mandela had, Lord Renwick. He goes to London regularly to get his instructions. There's a picture of him having cocktail parties with Lord Renwick, who was the man who packaged and organized Mandela and organized this whole PR campaign for the 1994 elections and all this. Lord Renwick is a Rothschild banker controller. He tells Juju what his next move is going to be. So, Juju is not anti-capitalist, anti-white. he's actually getting his instructions from these characters. If the average EFF person realized that they're being had and played, like the people in Zimbabwe, you can go to people in Zimbabwe who fought for Mugabe, who had dedicated ZANU-PF, and now realize we were used. Yeah. None of it was for our benefit. Zimbabwean people on the ground, even the people who fought for Mugabe and so on, they end up starved, bankrupt, jobless, nothing, starving in a refugee camp in another country, getting some food aid from some American Peace Corps worker. And, where's the honor and integrity in that? But they'll say what the people want to hear, but they've got another agenda. I mean, I've traveled to too many persecuted countries to miss this now. This is just getting too obvious.
Father, Rothschild also been through the United Nations.
Oh.
Because they're all linked to Planned Parenthood, who are...
Yes, no.
Money from them, you
have
to follow all these liberal sexual.
Do you know who gave the land to the UN and the building and so gave it to? John D. Rockefeller. He's one of the Rothschild people, actually. Some of them changed their names with marriage. But John D. Rockefeller gave the UN their territory. Who paid the first money to start the World Council Churches? Saint John D. Rockefeller. He funded the start of the World Council Church at the same time as he was starting the United Nations. One world religion, one world government. Revelation 13. One world government, one world religion, one world economic system. And you find the people who want a one world economic system are the ones funding one world religion and one world government. I think it's all over the place. Agenda 2 is probably the best first introduction film to it. Masters of Deceit. It's a 2-hour thing. We've got you an excellent documentary. It's staggering. And Stephen Goodson, from a South African perspective, he's written Inside the South African Reserve Bank, and he's written A History of Central Banking and Enslavement of Mankind, where he describes it. For example, just take this. Do you know in the Middle Ages, 13th, 14th centuries, the average worker only had to work about 140 days a year and had about 180 holidays a year. And it's because they had this tremendous amount of free time that they built the cathedrals. It's just amongst the spontaneous expression of the Christian culture and their joy. But once they got into the bankers, and they let these cursed, blasted, damned Rothschild bankers, Rothschild being Redshield, and his symbol was the hexagram, you know, six lines, six triangles, six points, basically six, six, six is Redshield. And this hexagram on it, which is now on the dollar notes, the Rothschilds managed to ingratiate themselves with the royal families of Europe in order to borrow money from the banks and charge interest to the taxpayers. And people had to do more and more and more work until the workers had to do mostly work and very little holidays. And, of course, wars are the best way of getting people into even more debt. The whole point is getting us into debt. Getting you into such debt that the more in debt you are, the more enslaved you are. And I think at the end of it, this is the satanic, Luciferian, anti-Christian, anti-family, anti-life agenda. It's not just about money and power, but money and power is a means to a satanic end. That's way off topic, of course. Yes?
Exactly. Correct. Corrupt, evil, satanic, that's a good summary. And I wouldn't have said that before I heard Stephen Goodson. Stephen Goodson was director of the Southern Reserve Bank for 9 years. And his lectures and books on economics, and I must say, it's opened my eyes to a whole different perspective, because I'm not anywhere interested in economics, except insofar as it affects history. So when I saw the economic dimension to history, that staggered me. I mean, imagine the fact that we don't need to work as long as we do. And yeah, we could be spending a lot more time in arts and crafts and sciences and ministry and charity and environmental concerns and improving God's work. But you've got to do so much to pay off the interest on debts. The best thing I ever learned from economics is never get into debt. If you're in debt, get out of it quick. Stay out of it. Debt is the worst thing you can do.
Buy things cash. Debt is, you can have it all now, but they're not quite letting you know the higher purchase costs and all. You could have bought the same thing multiple times over if you just bought it in cash instead of paying off the interest that we pay for a lack of patience. But then tax. And while this isn't, again, part of the subject, but the biggest thieves are the government. According to the African Union, our government steals a quarter of the GDP, the gross domestic product, one quarter of the GDP is stolen every single year. We're talking about over R1 trillion. Any idea how much money that is and how big it is? If you put 100 rand bills on pallets, you double stack the pallets. So 1 ton a pallet, 2 ton pallet. So you've got double stack, 2 ton pallets. It would fill a football field.
According
to African Union, study on corruption, our government steals one quarter of the GDP, gross domestic product, a year. So when they start talking about, you know, Jan van Riebeck and Cecil Rhodes, so, give us a break. This government is stealing not billions, trillions of rand from the population, and they want to distract you by, and to the latest scapegoats are the farmers. I mean, okay, and then once the commercial farms are gone, then what? Well, then it's game reserves, and then factories. We know how this plays out. We've seen it in Zimbabwe. What is it? Distraction. Mugabe owns billions. 15 billion he's personally worth. They've got the fourth largest, not the fourth largest, they've got the, one of the largest diamond production mines in the world right now in Mereng. A full quarter of the world's diamond production comes from Zimbabwe. A quarter. Nothing goes into public treasury. It's all gone to China or to Mugabe's personal wealth. This is what these people do. Do you know what the biggest crime you can commit in South Africa is? Illegal diamond buying. they've got a special function, a special branch of police that deal with illegal diamond buying. You would spend more time in prison for illegal diamond buying than for murder, kidnapping, racketeering. Even worse than tax evasion. I mean, can you believe? Even worse than tax evasion. If you have a diamond on your farm and you find it, it belongs to De Beers. Whether you're in Namibia or in South Africa, every diamond, no matter where it is, whether it's on your land or wherever, you scuba diving in Orange River and you found it, it belongs to De Beers. It's the law in this country. It's the most important law. It's higher law than anything else. It's far more important than don't murder your neighbor. According to the penalties, illegal diamond buying is the worst crime you can commit in Namibia or South Africa. De Beers owns this government and they own Namibia as well. They own them. How else can you explain it? Every diamond in this country belongs to them, unless they sold it to you, that is. Every uncut diamond's theirs. No matter whose property it's found on, no matter who finds it. It's bizarre. And you would have thought that law changed in 94? Not on your life. They increased the penalty for it. Mandela was even more owned by De Beers than the previous government. Staggering. Anyway, the link between De Beers, Anglo-American, Rothschild banks, I mean, it's all totally intermeshed.